Okay, here we go. Hello. It's October 16th, 2018, and I'm here in the Mossy office with Linda Newman. Linda, what position did you retire from the university? You were an associate dean of the...
Assistant dean. I retired from being assistant dean in the School of Education and returned almost immediately to do 4 years as an ombud, which was a quarter-time position with three other retired faculty and or academic staff working as ombuds with employed people at UW-Madison.
Well, Linda, let's start from the beginning. We'll pause here while I turn up the volume. So where were you born?
I was born in New York City. My parents respectively had come to New York from fighting in Spain, my father against Franco, and my mother, after she graduated from Smith, where she had studied with Earl Curdy, took a year and went to the Soviet Union, and that would have been 1936. And then they met in New York working for the taxi industry, which famously went on strike. And my parents married July 5th of 1940, and I was born in New York City May 24th of 1941.
So your parents had a shared interest in radical politics, it sounds
yes,
like.
Yes, and that's really what brought them together. Apart from that, they had very little in common, but that was more than enough to bring them together and keep them together. My dad grew up Jewish in mostly Irish Harlem, and he was a very good hater, would be the way I would say it, beginning with the Irish. My mother grew up in Darien, Connecticut, which was as WASP as it could be. And her older sister, whom I adored, was the one person to vote Democratic. I think it may be in the election when Teddy Roosevelt was elected, I'm not sure. But they were an interesting combination, to say the least.
That's, to have that shared meaning, the shared, well, ideology,
yes,
seems to have worked for them.
It worked for them, and mm-hmm. in terms of our conversation, very much, what would I want to say, drove my mother's fascination with meeting George Mossy.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm happy to report that she has talked with Troy about being Curdy's student in Northampton, Massachusetts. And then when I came to campus, when I started as a graduate student in 1962, Merle Curdy had us over to the house. So I came with a pretty good credential for mm-hmm. the UW-Madison History Department. I was very much in ignorance of all that. I had studied English literature at Brown University and didn't really switch over to history until I realized I hadn't learned anything or enough yet. And when I talked to my parents about what to study in graduate school, my mother said very emphatically, you have to study history. That's what there is to learn, and you're going to learn it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Period. Well, and their immersion in history and
exactly.
their shared understanding of the importance of politics and engagement
and passion
for
right.
that would have indicated that they would want you to do the same thing.
And I can brag that in 1948 I helped to campaign for Henry Wallace.
Oh, for him.
So I am also immersed in politics, although I never considered myself to be as much of a radical as they always were, but I loved, especially in retrospect, the friendships that were in and out of the house and the fascinating people who were friends. My mother and the daughter of friends of theirs have got themselves a great deal of information from the FBI about how closely we were followed when I was growing up in New Haven. I'm not so interested in it, but there it is.
Mm-hmm. Have you accessed your parents' files or?
No.
My mother did, and this friend Mary Kushner was out here visiting just before my mother passed, and they had a wonderful time comparing notes.
Oh.
It's redacted, but they got out of it what they could.
Well, we've just requested George's file.
Wonderful, and good for you.
Because, you know, he was fingered to Hua House
right.
on American Activities Committee by Daniel Borst, because George was in a Marxist reading group at Harvard with Dirk Struick, who was a physics professor at MIT and was a Marxist. Of course, George's interest in ideology in Marx, who he admired greatly, would have drawn him to that.
Of course, but nothing to do with bursting was an idiot anyway.
Yes.
What a ridiculous thing to have done.
But, and you can imagine in those years, as a recent exile, immigré, and also a gay man, what that must have meant to George in terms of his sense of security.
Exactly.
So, yes,
exactly.
I think it was a huge thing. And it's something that he never talked about, and I couldn't get him to include in his memoir. So that tells me that it did have
quite
an immense impact.
It must have. And
yeah.
as much as most of what I remember of George, I believe he told me, but I have read memoirs, but I knew he was disgusted with the idea of having to come to the United States at all.
He was.
When I think at that point he was in England.
That's right.
But he did not want to come here. For so many good reasons. Not that I heard the reasons, I didn't need to.
I think he was, at that point, attempting to turn himself into an English gentleman.
Of course.
And so
a
this
nice
was,
fit.
Yes.
Potentially, although
yes.
we would have missed so much.
Well, and I think, you know, this is what his cousin did. Well, not his second cousin.
Right.
Werner Hosse.
I didn't know that at all.
Yeah.
And did he spend his life in England?
He did.
Okay.
And the differences between the two are striking.
I'm sure they are.
Yes,
and
very
did you
striking.
Know Werner then?
I met him once.
Okay, but you knew of him through George.
Yes, yes.
Of course.
But that's a whole nother story, but so we perhaps don't want to
take
too much time. But so you had then this interest in history.
Oh,
and,
yes, very much so. And when I walked into Merrill Jensen's office in Bascom, when I came to graduate school, he said to me, "What are you interested in?" And I said, "Well, colonial or revolutionary?" "Well, which one is it?" I said, "Colonial." He said, "Lovejoy, around the corner."
That was it.
Which was perfect. I mean, Lovejoy and I got along so well.
Great.
And I worked in the department when I was a graduate student. I worked with David, but I also worked with Bill Williams.
Mm-hmm.
And I also had... was it maybe Gaines Post? I'm not sure, but I felt as if, especially looking back, that I intersected with so many different phases of the history department. I was a graduate student, and then I was the undergraduate advisor, and then I was a School of Education assistant dean, but maintaining my contacts. And the friendships were much later than my graduate student days, so that was Suzanne Desan, and Steve and Florencia, and George. And then, as you probably know, Steve Fireman was just here for the Mancina lecture, and that really brought back to me the layering of the friendships. Because the people that I loved so much when I was working in the department were Fireman and Dower, and then the new people were McDonald and Stern and Sachs. And immediately upon becoming the undergraduate advisor, I was friends with George. I had the office across the hall. And he was beyond gracious, always. And of course, profoundly engaged with undergraduates. And I didn't think about it. That's just who he was. And one gay undergraduate student, I was completely unaware of my own sexuality. Not the brightest woman in the crowd. But we both were very devoted to a young man named Mark Betchko. And he's out there in the world somewhere. But that was really fun.
I remembered Mark.
Yeah.
I drove to Minneapolis with him because he, like so many undergraduates and graduates, kept contact with George throughout George's life.
Right.
This, of course, was not so typical.
Not at all. But there was nothing typical about George that I can think of. The other undergraduate whom we both adored, and I know you know, is Andy Bachman.
Yes.
And that was an enormously powerful commitment from me to Andy and Andy to George, and not necessarily any kind of circle there. It was just we both absolutely love Andy.
So you came to Madison, your mother knew Merle from when he was
Smith, and he radicalized her. He taught Scottsboro Boys, and that took her right to the left. She tells the story of him, Curdy, walking across the campus at Smith with my mother's best friend, Margot Caddy, and saying to Margot, "Miss Nielsen is moving to the left." And that was my mother.
Well, there are recordings of Merle from 1943.
Wow.
Where he speaks out against war.
Right.
And is very adamant that no war is really justified.
Right.
And this is quite courageous in the middle of World War II.
And my mother lived in their house. She graduated in 35. Between that date and when she went to the Soviet Union, she lived with the Curdys, and she worked with Merle on peace and war. And as she tells the story, she's the one who said, "You cannot call it war and peace." I don't know, but that's what she says.
So you arrived in Madison in 1962 to this world famous and very highly recognized and appreciated department. Department that in many ways was the opposite to Harvard and Yale. It was the more radical history.
And that was part of why I applied. But I applied to Brown and I applied to Yale and I applied here, and here's the only place I got in. So that added
lucky
to,
you.
Oh, I'll say. Oh, I wouldn't have liked either of the other two places at all.
The kind of history they were doing in those days in particular would have probably not resonated with you or your family. But,
and what was very clear as I look back on it is here also it was extremely male dominated.
Yes.
And I did not know to question that initially. That came, but not initially.
So you came and you worked with Lovejoy.
I worked with Lovejoy. I worked for LitRec doing research on, I think, Black history. I know it was Black history, and I think it was right after the Civil War, working in the Historical Society. I also worked in the Historical Society for Nathan Glob? No, Charles Glob and Larry Larson, who were in the office that was Alice Smith when she was doing Wisconsin history. So I did research on Menasha, working for them. And that's where I was literally when John Kennedy was killed. It was up in that part of the Historical Society. Don't know that. And then I taught history for Larry Vesey and Paul Glad, just one or two, before my son was born. So that would have been in 1966.
Okay. So tell me a bit about your impressions of Madison in those years, your circle, about the department, and then we'll move on to your friendship with George.
The circle I was in, I met Ken Bowling here, and he's
former husband.
Right,
yes.
And along the way we got married, and he was a Jensen student, but I think for the most part, my friends were Cronin students, so U.S. history students. And I took a course from Cronin, and I didn't think much of him. I took a course from Taylor. I can't remember what Taylor's first name was. I was crazy about him as a historian. And I was very close to Ron Story and his wife Ellen. His wife Ellen worked for Merrill Jensen, and Ken whom I married, was Merrill Jensen's graduate student. And Ron worked for, oh Lord, I'm not going to remember, but he left, that professor left here and went to Stony Brook. And I think he was U.S. culture, but I just don't remember his name. And Ellen and I and Ron and Ken were very, very close friends. And Ellen, when Ellen and Ron moved to Amherst, because he taught at UMass after that, I stayed very close to them. I know I knew Joan Scott, but I don't, and Don, but I don't think well. I mean, I think I was at history events with them. I was friends with Frank Cook, who went on to become the archivist, and with Marianne Gebelein, who became his partner, and she was a graduate student, but I don't know who she worked with. And Lovejoy's students, John Rainbolt, I believe, was one of them. And there was somebody working for Lovejoy who went into the Wisconsin, I mean, to the Madison schools to teach history. And I'm very clear that when I moved here, I lived on Langdon Street with Ken after we got married, and I'm trying to think about where I lived before that. I lived on Broome Street with an undergrad who was just finishing up. I'd been friends with a friend of hers at Brown, and then two young women. They didn't seem young to me; they were my age, but. One getting her PhD in Italian, and one getting her PhD, I think, in French. So I knew those people, and I knew Germaine Bray, only in the sense that she sort of wafted through the rooms. I didn't know her well. And it's hard to say, well, I didn't get to know George until I was hired.
Yes.
In the history department.
But you met Chuck Thoreau and Dale Hillerman, and was that, were you engaged politically? Because that period, when you came in 62,
oh, yes.
People like Paul Brynas were here. I don't know if you knew Paul.
I didn't know Paul at all, and I didn't know anybody politically in the department.
Oh, really? Okay.
But my son was born in 67, Ken's and my son, and we were up and down State Street constantly. And protesting
the war
mm-hmm. absolutely mm-hmm. And I remember after I was hired as the history department advisor, I was distributing evaluations, which is part of my job. I'm trying to think who this guy was, whoever it was who went to Stony Brook. We hired this guy who was vaguely Southern for a history of American ideas, culture. And he was lecturing, saying to them, there were National Guard troops on the steps of Humanities, if you can imagine it. And the flames were just flying out of my ears. I didn't say anything. A little more respect, if you don't mind. And I was here for the strike.
In 60, that would have been 69, right?
Yeah.
When the National Guard did come on campus.
And also
yes.
The TAA
right,
was
exactly.
on strike, and
right.
I was very torn, and I remember there was a grad student, again, I don't remember his name, who told me I was part of management, and I was furious. He, in fact, was correct, but my political education was minimal. My passions were extreme, so, and somewhere along...
Not unusual for young
right,
people, right.
Along the line there, I also drove cab and went on strike and helped to create Union Cab, but that's a little later. And was involved with Jess and whoever he was with the alternative newspaper, Ron McRae.
Oh, Ron McRae,
yep.
Yes, and Jess Anderson? Or
yep,
right?
Yep. But mostly that was through Chuck and Dale and David. So I think, and Ken and I lived with John Steinhardt and his family for 2 years, 70 and 71, when they were in a commune-like setting across the lake and then in town, sort of rented mansions.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the point at which Kenneth got involved with David, And through Ken and David, I met Chuck, Dale, and David, all of whom I love devotedly. And Chuck, we could say most of all. And Dale was certainly very, very interested in history. And I believe that Chuck did his master's in urban planning.
Urban planning, and Dale was in American history here, but didn't, I think he didn't finish his PhD.
Right.
But I should mention Chuck and Dale came to Madison after meeting and on the Freedom Rides.
Right,
and
they were at Tubular.
Yes, right.
And I didn't know about the Freedom Rides.
Yes.
And another undergraduate that I was very much involved with when I was working with IES, now I'm not going to remember, but a young man everybody fell in love with except me or Chuck. But we both adored him. And he died. I mean, and there's Duncan. I knew Duncan early. And there's the poster that you had out there.
Oh,
in the
library. Yes.
And one of the young men in that poster died.
Yes. And this was, we should say, a group of young gay men at the time that they were coming out, but also really the formative generation for gay rights.
Yes.
And in those days it was called gay liberation.
Yes, exactly.
And so they had created this community.
Yeah.
Yes.
Very much so.
Yeah.
And I was very much of a part of it, still not realizing that I'm gay myself. That just came along. But I remember once going out and talking with Dale, and the lesbian hadn't showed up, so I stood in, so to say, live and learn.
Oh, well.
Yeah.
So it was an exciting, would you like some water, Linda?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, I think we may only have sparkling water, but.
Sparkling water is fun.
Okay, it does, when you're talking. One without a flavor. Oh gosh, it has cherry. Is that all right?
Of course.
Okay. They'll hear this, but I don't think they'll include it in the transcript. I hope they edited it out. Yes. So yes, it was. It certainly was an exciting time. I came in at the tail end, and in high school I was involved on campus, and then came here in 1970. But was often on campus in 68, 69.
So where did you go to high school?
West.
Okay.
So I have some feeling of what it was like, but not only the intense and often very divisive politics, but also the incredible sense of possibility and this idea of changing the world, but also having the, courage and sense of empowerment to change the future, and that anything was possible. And I think that is something that is very difficult to convey to young people now, because they
completely agree.
Completely are different.
Different. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was one of the things that I think about when I think about it is so completely taken for granted.
Yes.
That we were changing the world, and at the closest level, the relationships, the friendships, the love was so powerful. And George was right in the middle of it.
Yes,
and
he was.
Never, he was the least hierarchical person I ever knew. I mean, by far. Just interested. Anywhere you sat him down, he just was interested. And he didn't have to say anything. And I don't know that you would remember, but when we did one of the tributes and he passed, Gerda couldn't be there and gave me her text.
I was there. That was the memorial service.
Right. And that's when she said, she told me he couldn't name that book, Curious George. But it's perfect. It's just absolutely perfect.
Well, I think that was so striking about George, is that he came from such privilege. And yet he was a very modest person, in some ways even humble.
Yes.
And he didn't play this kind of professor game where he had this arrogance or
nothing.
And that's, I think, hard for people to understand who just heard him in lecture where he had that authoritative voice.
Of course he did.
Because that was very serious business for him. But as a, on a personal level, he was so friendly and didn't have that kind of, sense of grandeur that someone in his position could have had, given
his accomplishments.
Oh my goodness,
he was entitled to it.
Yes.
But he never had it. And there were so many stories, but one of the stories I loved was his, wherever he was skiing in Europe, as a very young person, just stopping the elevator so he could talk to the princess, because
mm-hmm.
he just wanted to know
mm-hmm.
what it was like to be a princess.
Yes. That was George. He did have intense curiosity up until the end of his life, and he never lost that.
Never.
Always was so
and
engaged, yes, that's
was
very true.
Then, I think, some degree of athlete and a skier.
That's right, he was.
And I think loved it. Because I don't think there's very much that George did in his life that he didn't love. I mean, I don't think he would have seen any reason or felt the need to do things he didn't love to do. And so most of my friendship with him came from being neighbors in, around the corner here on the fourth floor.
And you quickly understood how intensely he was engaged with undergraduate education and
completely.
With the students, how important this was to him.
Absolutely. And there were various students where, as one of my Jewish students, woman, and I don't think I can distinguish her. I had Andy was one and she was one. They both became rabbis. She a very different order of beast. I don't think she's the one I'm thinking of, though. There was one who was in his seminar just arguing with him about everything all the time. And I'm getting his full respect for the ways in which she was going after him. I don't remember the content. But we would just visit across the hall. And John Barker was right there, too, and I would bring my dog, who very eventually bit Courtney, and then I had to keep him at home. But various people thought that
bit Courtney, okay.
A good choice. But I think mostly Boris visited John. I don't think George was, George had dogs all the time, but I didn't know that then. But I think Boris was much more enamored with John Barker, who kept food for him.
Boris the dog.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Absolutely. So I'm trying to think of the, in some ways, the biggest event in George's life that I was part of for years and years and years with various partners. I mean, you knew me with Barbara with George.
Yes.
But also the Vietnam veteran I married after Kenneth, Perry. Perry and I knew George, but was his holiday party.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we were always, I was always there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the French woman and her partner would be. I'm not remembering.
Elaine Marx and Yvonne.
Yes.
Yeah, Ozello.
Yeah.
Yes.
They would always be there. And then I think Judy came.
Mm-hmm.
Judy
Corcoran.
Yeah.
Yes, the graduate advisor. Yes, and most of George's friends in the history department, it was about 45, 50 people, and it was really a wonderful party.
Oh,
wasn't
it was so
Every
wonderful, and usually
engaging.
Catered
yes.
to people that he knew. The other way that I knew the house is that Charlie and Susie Bolton, and I think even after Conover came, the graduate students who lived there when George was, I assume, teaching in Israel. But he may have been teaching other places. And they would have the house. And I may have known some of the other people who lived there, but I don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
So the house was very much, I felt at home there. I liked it much better when George was there, but sometimes he wasn't, and that was okay too.
It was a very welcoming home. He had his undergraduate and graduate seminars there for many, many years, often very pioneering seminars on the history of sexuality for undergrads. And I think that for him it was an opportunity to test out ideas and also engage with the students in a very relaxed atmosphere.
Yeah, I agree.
But where you mentioned that woman in his seminar who loved arguing with him, George really particularly enjoyed informed argumentation, and he loved debate. He loved people had opinions that were different than his,
exactly,
that he could engage with on a certain level, as long
exactly
as they didn't just spoke slogans.
Oh, no, no, no.
So
no.
Did he appreciate her argumentation?
Oh,
I'm
sure.
Yeah.
I mean, I was never present, but she was so caught up with it, and I think some of the time really frustrated with him, and I'm sure he was unmoved, meaning
oh, yes,
he was perfectly willing for her to be, and she was as smart as she could be, but he wasn't going to give in. And I don't know the content, but I love him so much in that encounter because of the respect.
The respect that he gave the student, and
absolutely,
yes,
which she, on some level, completely took for granted. And there was no way in the world I was going to point that out to her. I mean, I admire George, and how would I want to say, also feel as if I am somewhat like him in being very interested in the other person, whoever it is, and it's not necessary to try to tell him anything. I mean, she had to do the work because she was doing the seminar, and I'm sure she did a good job. But his accessibility and his respect for everybody was staggering, and you took it for, one took it for granted. I mean, it was just, of course, that was George. And walking his dog in the cemetery to go pee on the people that felt needed to be peed on.
I always thought perhaps he trained them to do that because it was uncanny.
Yes, I think he did.
And he got such a kick out of it.
Harvey, I knew Harvey, especially close to his death, very well. But I didn't know them in tandem. I mean, I think probably even after Harvey died, George's stories about Harvey, but I didn't know them at all when I was working in the department. And I was close with the woman who eventually married Maury Mizer, and I think then had to be Harvey's student.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was in that circle because I was crazy about Maury. I mean, platonically, God help me, but just absolutely loved him. There was such wonderful faculty members there, firemen among others.
Yes.
And I was very close to Liz.
Linda's talking about various faculty members of that period, which we will look up and include in the transcript. But yes, this question of George's respect for students, undergraduates, graduates, students, and sense of responsibility, and I think that came out very much in the 60s, where,
yes,
unlike some other professors, he did fully engage, but he didn't over-engage, and he didn't try to become a advocate.
Not at all. Not at all. And I think I remember that he was one of the faculty members who had a standard for the faculty,
mm-hmm,
that was very, very high.
Very high.
And I think he and I shared, although I couldn't promise you this, some disappointment with some of the members of the American Caucus,
yes,
just in terms of their seriousness about the discipline of history and also their responsibility to the department and their students, graduate students and undergraduates.
Mm-hmm. I think that was crucial for George.
I agree.
I think that generation, there was probably more of that, perhaps, than there is now. That,
oh, I think so.
Real devotion to the department, to the institution.
And to Hebrew University. It was his great good fortune to have institutional integration and support in places that were equal to the magnitude of of his gifts.
Yes.
He was utterly and completely extraordinary, and you never had to notice so long as you didn't waste his time, but much more importantly, the department's or the discipline's time. He had no use for that at all.
Very high standards.
Extremely high, and would never have described them that way.
No.
That was a given.
It was a given. It was where the bottom line.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that is something that is very difficult for some people to understand or to even think of, matching. It is a huge...
And it's almost 19th century.
Yes, I agree. I do think it comes out of his family background and his...
Of course
European,
it does.
Yes, it's very much a part of that family progressive tradition and belief in building in the power of education. I think this was their faith, really.
Completely.
Yeah.
Having to do with ability.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I'm sure on some level a commitment also to physical effectiveness, which I think of as the skiing. I love just knowing that.
And he skied well into his 60s.
Good.
And then had to give it up. But he was on the Cambridge ski team, and I always remember him saying, well, you know, these beautiful calves of mine are from my skiing on the Cambridge ski team, which I was skeptical of. But anyways. But he was.
I love that.
Yeah, he had the greatest sense of humor, as you know. George was so funny. He just,
and so willing to laugh at himself.
Yes.
But not invite, I mean, he didn't ask you to do anything. If he felt like you were true to yourself, then you were welcome. And that was it.
Well, George was very sensitive.
Oh.
Although you would, it wasn't in the kind of way that you might think today sensitivity manifests itself. It wasn't a kind of, for lack of a better word, a kind of trigger warning sensitivity or any of that. It was more that he had a real empathic understanding of other people, but he would never tell them what he thought they should do or what.
Nope.
Unless it was their graduates, his graduate students, then he might sometimes tell them.
Sure.
But this brings up the other side, and that is that George, because of his high standards, I think sometimes, and also his German background,
sure,
he sometimes perhaps didn't give people enough of a chance, in the sense that...
That might be true.
Yes, it was something that I, especially with graduate students, if he kind of decided whether you were worth, you know, he understood, and he was probably a master at it, because what he was looking for was intense engagement.
Exactly.
And a sense of discipline, and so he didn't want to take on students. Yes. And so I think that was wise in a sense, because he probably was one of the greatest graduate trainers of his generation, given
so.
What happened to his students, their subsequent careers. But it did, I don't know if that kind of attitude would really work now, in a sense.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
And I think it's a huge loss. But two or three times now, you and I have reached a place where we know, we feel like we know it's something we could not explain.
Yes.
And I think this is the same way.
Yes.
That it was a given, that's not perfect, for him, that he would behave that way. And he assumed that the students would find the person who would call that out of them if it wasn't he.
Yes, I think that's really the key, that if it wasn't he, that they would, if they really had the commitment, that they would follow through on it.
That's right.
It was giving the individual a lot of, empowerment for their own education.
And responsibility. And then I think he was wonderfully, and honest again is an inadequate word, but the integrity of the man is extraordinary. And he would not allow you to come if he didn't recognize something in you that meant he could work with you. But it wasn't, there was nothing to it except no.
Mm-hmm.
There was no extra energy around it. This one is yes, that one is no, and, you know, God keep you and success and so forth, but not with me.
Mm-hmm.
Done. Mm-hmm. Just.
So, do you recall any experiences from when you were the undergraduate advisor that related to George's teaching in particular? I know you mentioned a few students, but how undergrads in his classes may have responded to him as a teacher. By that time, he was already getting towards the end of his career.
He was.
We forget he started teaching in 44.
Right.
So.
And for me, I don't even know what kinds of lecture courses he was teaching. What I knew were the seminars, and
okay.
the undergraduate seminars, because I was there at the point in which that became a requirement. Not, it may have been before I ever showed up, I don't know. But that was an incredibly important piece for the students that, as I worked with them to figure out which seminar was going to work for them. And then it was the tremendous excitement when George did a seminar, and he didn't do it often, he didn't have to. And I also think, as I recall, that he was fairly interested in the students who would study abroad at Hebrew University. I mean, I don't think it was anything like what we got after he passed and left the money, but I think there was some undergraduates would go, and would go because of him. I
mm-hmm.
think that's accurate.
Mm-hmm.
But
yes, I think you're right, and I think that whole interaction with graduates at the Hebrew University, and then encouraging Israeli students to study with him and get their PhDs here, like Steve Asheim, Ari Kamon, and a few others, was a kind of template for then what he
exactly.
wanted with his state gift to happen.
Exactly.
And yes, I mean, God only knows what he would think of the current situation in both countries.
And thank you for mentioning it, because sometimes I really, really get heartbroken. I mean, Israel and Palestine break my heart every time I think of them, but to think of them in the context of his vision for what was possible, and I absolutely believe it was possible. It didn't happen. It has not happened, and what's happened is worse than a nightmare. And it's sort of like, I'm glad my mother didn't live to see 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And for George not to have to put up with the current treatment of Palestine.
Although, you know, Linda, I think George knew the direction that politics was going in Israel, and he was so prescient and understood history so well that I don't think he would be surprised by Trump either. I think George's work really in many ways is validated, unfortunately, by the kind of politics that we're having right now in both places. But I recall that when Rabin was assassinated, George really, that whole evening, he didn't speak, and I think he was thinking through what he saw was going to happen, because right before he died, he really did tell people that he knew in Israel that they had to leave, that, you know, that he understood that the left was going to become marginalized there. But they didn't. They stayed, and the left, you know, it's just quite extraordinary that they have that commitment. And
they had his insight.
Yes, and he would have kept going. I mean, I think George would have still been very engaged in Israel. He wouldn't have.
No, he couldn't have.
No.
I mean, observer
mm-hmm.
is not a role he ever took
mm-hmm.
for even a minute.
And, you know, I think because of his understanding of the divisions in the Jewish community in the 30s and how that really allowed the Nazis to take such advantage for it's a weak word, but how they played on those divisions.
Sure.
That he felt that commitment to Israel was so necessary for him, for his generation, and personally, yes. And that vision, you know, of Zionism with a human face. Because, of course, he understood the power of nationalism. He understood the power of racism. He saw that all-inclusive, unfortunate appeal of these two together, you know,
exactly.
And plus religious belief. And these are the three things.
Intolerance.
Yes, intolerance, yes. Well, I don't want to take up more of your time, Lynn, because, you know, we've been speaking for now 50 minutes, and that it is, and perhaps we could do this again.
Mm.
You know, we'll think about other.
I would love it.
Okay. But I just wanted to ask you if you had any. One thing is that I recall that strong sense of community that you mentioned earlier in the history department, and that was community of staff and some of the faculty. But I recall that you and Judy Corcoran, who was the graduate advisor, and George, and Sterling, and others on the faculty, that you were socially engaged with each other, not just at work, that you had a sense of community, a sense of looking out for each other.
Right.
So tell me a little bit about that, and then your personal appreciation of you got out of this department and that community.
Partly it was the babies, the baby caucus. And I was trying to remember precisely. I know McDonald and Sachs were in it. And
these were the newer faculty
they
members?
They were new when I was on the, you know, on my watch, they were new. And I can't remember if Stern was one. I don't think so. But I'm not sure who the third person then would have been. And I know George and I shared, I'm pretty sure I'm accurate about this, a tremendous admiration / love for Chuck Coleman. And Chuck came later than Sachs and McDonald. Then I was close, very close with Suzanne, personally. And as I mentioned, crazy about John Dower, John more for how brilliantly I thought he taught, so I was always encouraging my students to work with him. I wasn't so much encouraging students around George because he didn't need it. I mean, it was perfectly obvious that when he was teaching, students would be studying with him, and I would know those students as I knew George. I mean, George and I were, you know, if you go to church, love God, love your neighbor. And George was my neighbor in just the very finest sense of that, given our respective locations. And Judy was, and I were very close, and then there was the whole thing with Seal. I mean, that was a whole.
Who was Seal?
Seal was Judy's nemesis. And I got hired by Peter Smith, and I came in the day before, or the day after New Year's, because I started in January, and I had to understand that there was Seal, and then there was Judy, and I think Sharpless was one of Seal's faculty members, and then, of course, Judy was involved with Schultz. I have nothing to say on behalf of either one of them. But just trying to think who else on the faculty that I was really friends with. George.
And Sterling, were you friendly with Sterling?
Oh, very much so.
Yeah, I thought so.
Very much
Sterling
so.
Sterling Fisher, yes.
Yeah, and I had known sort of tangentially when I was a graduate student, well, not so tangentially, really. Let's see, Sterling divorced
Nancy? No,
he married Nancy.
Right.
But Nancy had been married to
God, I can't think of her name.
And
Krinsky, Bobby Krinsky.
Right. And so Sterling had been married to Bobby. and Nancy had been married to Krinsky. And I knew Hatch, Harriet Pakula Tooley's, was a very close friend of mine, Ann Ken's, and she was very close to Bobby. And then along the way, I got to know Sterling, and we cared for each other very much. And then I knew him in connection with George. I mean, that there was that friendship, and over time, I developed an enormous respect for Sterling, and then of course I moved over to the School of Ed. So I didn't, and I got to know Kasel, whom I hadn't so much known when I was in the history department.
And Sterling was also in the School of Ed,
exactly.
And he was one of George's PhDs, one
right.
of his early PhDs, who then also taught at Wisconsin for many years, was an excellent teacher.
Right, and I think was, I understood him to be, and then that shifted some, sort of an acolyte of George's.
Yes.
And then I kind of got over that, to recognize the strength of Sterling in and of himself.
Oh, yes.
And I also got to know Nancy. And my developing faith, although Christian, made a whole lot of room for Sterling, because my sense is he was much more observant than George was.
He became more observant as he got older.
Right,
also,
and I think I was real conscious of that. But also loving George. I mean, Judy, well, and you remember that dinner at the Kennedy Manor.
Right before
we lost
all of them in the last, and
yes.
So with Judy Corcoran, Sterling Fishman, and George, and you and me.
Yeah. And Barbara.
And Barbara, yes. And this was 1997, probably.
Probably, yeah.
And that was when I really understood that sense of community and connection that was evident in the department of those that were here in those years.
Right.
And
And Judy was such a force and so much beloved of George.
Oh, yes.
And that was so much where I understood his absence of class distinction, where his awareness of class was enormous and very, very finely tuned, having to do with, I mean, he was an aristocrat.
Right.
And he was the finest version of aristocrats, all to do with maintaining the standards, but you didn't talk about them.
You know, it was, I think George's Quaker education was very, very important in the formation of his attitudes.
Yep, and that was 11.
Yes.
When he got over here and was at
Haverford,
yes. That's
yes.
where my niece went there, and then my mother and George got to talk about it.
Oh.
And
yes.
of course, my mother had a huge crush on George.
Yeah.
Huge.
Because I think that's where some of his, well, egalitarian attitudes, but also his really amazing ethical.
Exactly.
I mean,
right.
certainly
exactly
that comes
right.
from his family also, but.
No, but it, you're right. It's
I think it's the combination of both together that made such a unique person.
I agree. And I think that was for that to have happened, because it was exactly what he needed. He needed to be exactly the young man he was in order for it to take just the way it did. Yes,
yes.
I think you're completely right.
Well, I think that our takeaway from our conversation has to be what an extraordinary person George was and how we miss him, but also how unique he was.
Oh,
and,
completely.
Yes.
And this isn't quite the right word, but available.
Yes.
I mean, if you encountered him, you never were the same. And there was no noise about him. I mean, just none. In Barbara's and my evolving conversation about life, clean is one of our absolute values in terms of another person. And George was as clean in that sense as they come. there was just no stack and no, nothing even remotely artificial. Nothing.
Well, thank you, Linda.
Oh, you're
that
welcome.
Was absolutely wonderful.
Thank you, sweetheart.
And
what an opportunity.
Well, we